I want to switch gears, but before I do, I want to give you a punchline on this that may not be, almost certainly is not obvious. I'm going to redraw this diagram, take the address space out, because I want to expand it to reveal something else. So the naive implementation of this structure is that each of reader, writer, and control has an endpoint, because that's how the client is going to invoke them. And then there's a single endpoint leading into worker that is both by reader, writer, and control, respectively. And that we have a max of reply caps that we're going to have to be prepared to store in the worker. The proposition is that the flaw in this design is in two places. One is pressure on the process table. And the second is the latency of invoking these processes only to forward the message. What I want to point out is we don't have to do that. One thing that's a little bit unusual here. How did we get down to three reply caps? We got down to three reply caps because we established an exclusive relationship between ourselves and our callers. So it was that exclusivity between the read thread and the worker thread that guaranteed that we would never have more than one outstanding read reply cap. Consequence of the exclusivity. There's a variant of this design which will allow us to avoid going through the reader thread unless there is actual observed contention. The proposition, or I have a yellow bit of, I had when I came in, a yellow bit of chalk, which is really useful about that. Talking with detail about the behavior of endpoints that is not apparent from their specification, but it's apparent if you apply sort of common sense to the specification. An endpoint has a process capability to its target. The question is, well, what's the behavior if I overwrite, if I replace the process capability? If nobody's in the middle of a call, it's not a big deal, right? Because there's no real question to answer. The next call, whatever it is, either the new capability is there or the old capability is there. Go wherever it says to go, and we're good. If there is a call where the call, the send phase, has made it all the way to the receiver, and the receive phase has not, still, nobody enqueued on the target process. If there is somebody enqueued, however, maybe there's an initial send in progress, or the process is not receiving, for whatever reason, and I go to invoke the endpoint, I end up enqueued on the target process until the target process enters a receive wave. If the endpoint is made to point at a different process, I'm not making any progress here, and it might be sensible for me to try to make progress someplace else. One likely scenario for why we would be redirecting the endpoint would be to get things unstuck as a recovery mechanism. So part of the contract, not documented, needs to be that if you replace the process capability in an endpoint, one of the things that will happen is that anybody who is blocked waiting for the previous process, the old one, will be woken up and will re-execute their operation. The idea is that the new process presumably will enter a receive rate, and anybody who has not made any progress, we would like them basically to migrate to the new process. In a perfect world, we would not wake everybody up. Unfortunately, we don't have good information about which endpoint they came in on that got them enqueued in this awkward state. Okay. And this big yellow piece of chalk, if I get a little yellow piece of chalk, I'll put this one down. Okay. And this is atomic with respect to the call, right? You will either go forward on the old process capability or the new process capability, but not both. Now, this raises the following interesting modification to this design. Just that the receive, read, write, and control processes are only going to be brought into memory when they are actually invoked. So suppose, change the picture a little bit, and we say under normal conditions, what we're going to do, I'm going to have those three endpoints point directly at the worker thread. I'm going to keep reads and writes and control separate. This structure still does that. Now they're coming in on different endpoints. If the worker thread gets a read request that it is able to fully satisfy, it's good. We're done. There's no queuing problem to worry about. The tricky part is when it has to enqueue. But notice that while processing the read request, it is not possible for any other request to come in. So those requests are enqueued, at least as a transient matter. We can exploit that fact. So one thing we could do is say, if we get to a place where we discover that we cannot fully satisfy the read request, then what we will do is we will reach up, whack the yellow pointer, and restore the white pointer. The effect of this is that any subsequent read request will go to the reader process. The reader process will in turn invoke the worker process, whereupon the worker process will now be in the awkward position of holding at most two reply capabilities related to the read channel. One that it initially accepted and is currently working on. One it just got from the reader process, which is the next request in that queue. So that's one and two. Requests three and subsequent are now blocked on the reader process. They were initially blocked in the worker process. When the worker process redirected the endpoint, they got woken up and they therefore moved themselves. One of them got through. So by making provision for storage in the worker for six reply caps rather than three, we move to a design in which these extra processes do not get into the picture at all until there is actual contention. That with some amount of buffering, and it doesn't even have to be enough buffering to handle all requests, because this will allow me to block in the middle of a request. Some amount of buffering. What we'll observe is that you have all the mechanism necessary to deal with the contention, but you will in practice never observe it in use. What's happening here is that the receiving driver is choosing to implement a design that does the simple thing until it realizes that it's in the potentially contended situation. And when it realizes it is in the potentially contended situation, it does a regime shift and manages the request flow in a different way. It's adaptive. So under normal behavior, these processes are logically part of the picture, but they're not actually invoked. And if they're not actually invoked, they induce no pressure on the process table. They're not even memory resident until they're invoked. The thing that keeps them in memory is their queues, which are not getting touched because they're not being invoked. So we've now converted an in-memory data structure that was putting pressure on the process cache and was adding latency into the request stream that most of the time wasn't buying us anything. Structure that can adapt. How does this design work better? Before I do that, do you see the idea? If you hold a capability of any sort to the serial port, you are entitled to make read and write requests. There's a way to be adaptive in a different direction. Not only is it the case that read and write requests rarely contend, read contention is low, and write contention is low. It's also the case that read-write contention is low. Early observed in practice on a serial drum. On the Ethernet, it's a whole different discussion. Notice that there's only one endpoint leading into the worker. There's no requirement that these three capabilities be differentiable in any way at all. The mere fact that I've gotten a read request tells me which party I'm blocking. In this case, we can combine the design with the collaborative design. I get one read request, I'm good. I can't finish it immediately, and then I get a second read request. I reply to the second read request by saying, try again. Before telling it to try again, I say try again, and I say try again over there, giving it this endpoint. If I am processing an uncompleted read request, and I get a write request, I say, please ask again over there, giving it the write endpoint. Now here's something interesting, right? It may have just gotten the best of all possible worlds because now the client only has to hold one capability. Right? The protocol is that the response from a read request is either the data you asked for or an excuse for why you're not going to get the data you asked for or a request that you asked in a slightly different way. And in principle, there are those three capabilities in the picture for the different channels. But dynamically, you'll only see them in this very local fashion. It won't hold one past the end of your read. So the concern was that the client had to commit storage for multiple capabilities. Now it may have to hold the second capability, but only in a transient way. And in contrast to the previous one, this one doesn't push you back halfway through a request. Once it starts your request, you own that channel. right? So there's no worry about reordering requests through the collaboration. Collaboration only got us in trouble with reordering. And if you don't call back, it's no sweat off my nose. Okay, I don't care if I'm a writer. Well, because if I ask you to call back, I have not started your request. Back, you never asked. Oddly enough, one thing about this, there may actually be a way to get rid of a lot of those processes. Because these processes really only exist to forward requests and to be blocked. So it could be that there could be a single universal process whose sole purpose in life was to be blocked at all times. And what I would do is simply ping pong the pointer back and forth between the universally blocked process and the process that's willing to take requests. And then I don't even need to multiply processes. So the catch here is we're looking at the serial driver, but we're going to see the same pattern emerge in the line discipline above it. We're going to see the same pattern emerge essentially in any Unix-style bidirectional stream. Asked during the break, well, do I have to do this at every level? Might it be the case, I'm paraphrasing this question, that I could design the serial driver so that all requests were best effort, and the caller was expected to call back if it needed to move more data. And so there is a design choice which says, look, if I could contrive to make it the case by specification that the worker thread only had one upstream client, then things get a whole lot simpler. Or if I could say, look, you have multiple upstream clients, it's on you to figure out what the hell to do about them. My contract is one of each type, and I will blow off the rest. Under what circumstances would that work? Under what circumstances would that be a viable design? In the case of a serial line, in practice, you almost always discover that there is a line discipline module sitting on top of it. The line discipline module has to deal with the concurrency issue because that's intrinsic in its function of doing line editing form. You therefore could push the concurrency management into the line discipline and make it responsible for concurrency management at the terminal level as well. Because you're exploiting an exclusive relationship between the line discipline and its associated terminal line. I don't really like that story. It's a clever approach. I like it in that sense. Right? I don't like the story because sooner or later, somebody will find a good reason to have two line disciplines speaking to the same serial line. I have a hard time imagining what that excuse might be. But I know it's the way of the world that people come up with really compelling reasons to do really boneheaded things. If you haven't observed this in the wild, wait a week. So this collaborative design, you know, the collaborative thing, might actually get us back into a single channel solution. And if we conclude that these processes serve no function other than to be active impediments, right, then we can simply have a universally non-receiving process, because all we're really after is its role as a queue. Its role as a queue comes about implicitly because it does not receive. Trying to figure out if I want to dig into this given the time we have or not. Well, let me start. We have two tools that you're going to need to know about. One is Capital, which I've mentioned a couple of times, and it does interface definition language. This is basically a way of saying what's the protocol between processes. Another is MakeImage. Right? MakeImage is where, imagine it this way. Suppose I'm building an embedded system with Linux. Somewhere there's a ROM or a flash device in this system. And what's in that flash device is a copy of the Linux kernel that the bootloader of the system knows how to load. And in the Linux case, a copy of the file system from which that kernel will then go read the world, where it will find the init program that it will exec as the first process. And there is built into the kernel knowledge of the file system, and that's how it knows where to find init. And internally, the kernel does a synthetic fork and exec in order to start the init process. One way to think about that is you have a kernel image and you have a system image. In Linux, a system image is expressed as a file system. The same is true in Kyotos. You have a kernel image and you have a system image. But in Kyotos, the system image is essentially a set of seven vectors. A vector of GPTs, a vector of processes, a vector of endpoints, a vector of pages, a vector of capability pages. And inside the image, inside of GPT, for example, there are certain slots that can hold capabilities. And last week I talked about how you find the object when you invoke a capability. You use the OID. There are capabilities that come from the ROM image. The OID is simply the index into the appropriate vector. So the very first entry in the vector of GPTs is the GPT whose OID is 0, at least at boot time. It may subsequently get destroyed and reused. The way this works, the kernel comes up, it finds the boot image, it allocates its in-memory cache, it copies the entities in the boot image into the in-memory cache, and then it drops the boot image on the floor. It already copied it, right? So by the time we go to run the first process, every object in the boot image is already in the object cache table, so we can locate it by the mechanism I went through last week. It begs the question, how do I build a boot image? And setting aside the mechanics of how I build a boot image, once I know the mechanics, what is it that I want to put into the boot image? So how do I build a boot image? This is the purpose of the make image program. Describe make image. The original version of make image was a statement language. It had no procedures, it had no iteration, it had no macros, it had roughly no nothing. It had statements that allocated objects, which means grow the vector by one object and initialize the state. And it had statements that assigned capabilities to capability locations. So a typical statement in that version of make image would be something like p equals new process p dot star 4 equals new page. And eventually, through the grace of the C preprocessor, a limited phenomenon if ever there was one, you would essentially build one very long file of these statements. And they would be executed in sequence, and that's how you fabricated an image. Of course, this meant that every variable was global, so we very quickly put in just a little bit of syntactic sugar that looked like it might have been a module system in another life. It was. But pretty soon we discovered there were things we wanted to do that were repetitive. Like, you would discover that you wanted to allocate a process, and there are always three steps, right? You allocate the process, you populate its address space slot, you give it a schedule, and you give it a source of storage, right? And these four steps, like, you never skip any of them, right? It's very idiomatic. And, of course, you really don't want to repeat these four lines because then somebody will go and change the idiom out from under you and now you have to fix it in 100 billion places. So pretty soon we said, oh, well, the secret processor, right? We're already using that. Macros are my friend. That this is when somebody says to you, macros are my friend, this is the time to shoot them and put them out of their misery. Macros and flat namespaces do not get along because then pretty soon you discover, oh, well, I need a temporary that I'll put the new process in so that I can populate its slot, and then you know the temporary will be the result of the macro. And this is just more horrible than you can possibly imagine. So we no longer use that version of make image. The good thing about it was that because everything was either an allocation or an assignment, you didn't have to think too hard to realize that the operations all had to complete. There's nothing here that does a loop. And if you don't have loops, you don't have general computation. Nothing here that does a branch. Make image is a programming language. Sort of. Or at least, well, that version of MakeImage, I would say, was a description language. It wasn't quite a programming language because it didn't have control flow.
And you abuse the C preprocessor to
help abuse you? And C preprocessor is redundant.
Okay.
Yes, we made abusive use of the C preprocessor. We abused ourselves with the C preprocessor to deal with these sort of repetitive things. And these are things that in any sane programming language you would have written the procedure for. And you can imagine morphing that language and saying, oh, well, we'll add procedures and we'll solve the termination problem by not allowing recursion. It seems like a kind of a doofus thing to do in a programming language, but remember, this is a very special purpose programming language, and termination is something we'd actually like to know about. You very quickly discover that recursion is a really useful thing to have. But once you step over the line into procedures, you're rapidly tempted into a general purpose programming language. The next thing is you discover that iteration is a really useful thing to have. Like, you want to initialize 16 slots to the same value. And not being able to just say that becomes old really quickly. fact, we didn't have iteration. So MakeImage got replaced. And there's now a new language also called MakeImage. It is practically close to C, but it's not C. Ironically, because I forgot to turn off the recursion, we may even still have an image around that implements iteration through recursion. I was completely disgusted by that. Here I've gone to all this work to make sure everything would terminate, and you know, it's like that Turing completeness thing really wants to escape. It's like information wants to be free. Programming languages want to be Turing complete. So the new language basically is these kinds of statements, but with a proper scoping mechanism, with procedures, and with at least do and while constructs, and I'm trying to figure out how to put in a for construct that won't horribly break the syntax of the existing language. Not that the syntax is in any way wonderful, but once you're stuck with it, you sort of don't want to do a big upheaval. The thing to note about this language, though, is that the purpose of running a program is for the sake of the side effects of the image that's being built. So ultimately, it's still the case that the new operations, which are the ones that allocate objects in the vectors, and the slot assignment operations, which are the ones that establish connectivity in the object graph, are the ones that matter. Everything else is convenience. This is not a good choice if what you want to compute is the last decimal digit of pi. It's slow. It's an interpreted language that's interpreted in the most grossly slow, straightforward way one could possibly imagine.
Yeah? This compiler.
We're interpreting directly off of the AST. And if you get really disgusted with that, blame Swaroop, because it was his idea. It was his idea in the context of a different language, but we stole it. It was a bad idea. It looked attractive. They stole it. Okay. In the new language, when you say new, there's an argument which says what bank it was coming from. So we learned a couple of things from the old language. The big one was, hey, we have this story about storage allocators in the system, and storage allocators have a hierarchical arrangement, and part of the point of that is so that you can destroy them. To destroy a storage allocator, you usually are also destroying all the space that came from that storage allocator. In the old version of MakeImage, more precisely, in the state of the arrow system as far as it had gotten, we hadn't yet gotten to the point where there was a really compelling reason to deal with storage allocators in MakeImage at all. Everything came out of the prime bank because none of it was ever going to go away. If you lost your console driver, somehow, it wasn't coming back. There wasn't any place to get another one, so it wasn't something you were going to destroy. We're now seeing cases where we want to be able to load software that can be destroyed, and so it's actually, when you say new page, it's important to say where it came from. So I said that it's a list of vectors of objects. It's almost but not quite true. There's an extra vector. The extra vector is the list of banks. And when the prime space bank comes up, when the prime bank comes up, it actually analyzes that vector to figure out what the bank relationships are that you created in MakeImage. Somewhere down in the area of storage allocation, MakeImage has this little incestuous self-knowledge of the bank mechanism. So, what kinds of things do you tend to say here? Let me give an example. Let me find an example. Those are not good examples. That's not a really good example. I printed all these things, figuring I would go through them online. Ha ha. Okay. Every unit of compilation, that is every input file in MakeImage, is a module. There's an import syntax. So the idea is when you do a define statement in a module, you're defining a symbol in the scope of that module. And the import syntax is generally of the form, okay, let me explain what this means. ID is an identifier that's going to get defined in your module, in the imported module. This is the name of the module that you are importing. It's a Java-style qualified name. What's going to happen is the dots are going to get converted into slashes, right? .mki is going to get appended, and MakeImage is going to go running down the search path trying to find the module you've asked for. If that module has not already been imported prior to this point, immediately be executed for the sake of whatever it does. And execution is going to have two effects. One is it's going to run statements that may allocate storage. And the other is the module may define procedures and may export them so that you might choose to call. There are two kinds of defining statements inside a module. statements that export their identifiers and statements that do not. So you can either say A equals 5, this is a semicolon term in the language, okay, or you can say export F A equals 5. Here's the difference. The first one, the one without the export, A is only visible within the scope of the module. Second one, with the export, A is visible to parties importing the module. So if I've said export def A equals 5, which in this language is not a hugely useful thing to do, then in an importing module, I can make reference to ID.A, where ID is the local name that I gave to this module. Just to make this concrete, right, I can say import the coyotes.runtime module, give it the local name RT, and there's an enumeration that's defined in that runtime module called rt.tools. It's just Nina, but it is a minute. There's an error, just...
Export variable is now a constant.
Okay. Which is arguably a bug. Actually, we're debating making them constant. Unfortunately, the low level, the very low layers of the system have one or two incestuous circular relationships. So while you might imagine making those bindings constant, the objects that they point to don't want to be constant. So suppose I want to establish in the initially running image, I have some program and I want a running process that is executing that program that's going to run in the initially running image. So one way that I could do that is I could say, all right, I have a utility module that knows how to deal with program images. It's actually called an image. I can, after importing that module, image module exports, among other things, a procedure called load. Load knows how to load my files. I need to import something else. In practice, you will discover that almost every module that's not trivial imports the space bank module. Because if you don't import the space bank module, you do not have a way to either reference or create a storage allocator. So having done that import, I can say I want to load an image from the binary file layout. The procedure internally is going to allocate a bunch of pages and a bunch of GPTs, and it's going to fabricate, it's going to build a tree out of them. It's going to allocate them from the supplied source of storage. Having done that, I could go and say, I can spell. Actually, I think PrimeBank may be a universal global. You may not even need the space bank module for that. So, having sort of told this lie, let me fix the example, because in practice, you almost never want to allocate a process from the PrimeBank, because the PrimeBank cannot be destroyed. But in practice, what we would probably do is, here, do something like, create a new bank, the child of the PrimeBank, and having created it, we would then use that new bank. So I've got this process.
Do this one correctly.
I can say, oh, make the address space of this process be, I'm going to follow the pattern. So look, the idea here is I'm basically programming the capability slots by hand. They're going to make up this process in an address space. I'm also going to have to give it a reply endpoint. If the process does not have a reply endpoint, it will never be able to get one, because in order to invoke the space bank, I have to have a way for it to reply to me, and in order for it to reply to me, I have to have a reply endpoint. Of course, this would be hopelessly cumbersome if I had to write the necessary 15 statements every time I fabricated a process. So there's another utility module that knows how to do all these things. You basically pass it the image name, pass it the bank you want it to come from, you pass it the schedule capability, that's something else you have to set up, and it will just go and do all of this. That's why we had procedures, and so forth. What I would suggest you do is, I'm just looking for one that's a good one to look at. If you poke around in the tree and look at, probably the best one to look at right now is the MKI file for virtual copy space. I will caution you about this one because probably by tomorrow, I would say, look at the MKI file for Text Console. The reason Text Console will be a good one is there's only one of them in the system. Virtual copy space is not a module whose job is to define a new process. It's a module whose job is to define mechanisms for creating pieces of new processes. So there's sort of one extra level of indirection try and move through it. But what I would suggest is start with virtual copy space and just try to trace your way through the MKI files, figuring out what each piece is doing. For comparative purposes, and when you see something of the form p dot adder space or something like that, what you're looking at is probably either a field assignment or a capability slot assignment. And if you look in the kernel tree in the sysopstore directory, you will see the underlying data structures that are actually being populated by those statements. There's a pretty close correspondence between
the two. No, are you kidding?
So when I come back to this next week, I will have a better example for you. I will bring my laptop, which hopefully we will be able to get the display out of, and I'll actually show you how a real one works. And by that point, I will have Text Console cleaned up enough that it would be a reasonable example. There's a subtle difference. There are a few cases in MakeImage files where you end up just allocating objects. So an example is there's something called the primordial zero space, right? It's an enormous space full of zeros, and it consists of a single page. Single page is basically mapped again and again and again and again and again and again. Right? And there's one GPT above it, which has the same page mapped. It's a read-only zero page. One GPT above that, which has the first GPT mapped at every slot. There may be one or two other things like that, but in general, you don't end up using this scheme to define dangling objects. You use MakeImage either to define processes that should be primordially running at system boot time, or constructors that you will later invoke to get an instance of a process created. For itself, is a process that needs to be primordially running at boot time. Watch out for that level of indirection. Right now, most of the stuff that we have is very low in the system, so virtual copy space and constructor both have that level of indirection built into them, and we're building the first few examples of MKI files for just standalone processes. Things like Text Console, which have been floating around, the version of Text Console, if you want to look at how to build a primordial process, have a look at textconsole.mki. But do it quickly, because sometime in the next 2 days, that's going to get converted over to the constructor model. Also, if you find MKI files that are sitting down in test directories, usually you see as a common pattern, the test program will simply be instantiated by hand. It will then turn around and invoke a constructor, build whatever it needs to test, test it, and then destroy it. That'll show you both patterns. As you start digging into the MKI files, look at Text Console, look at virtual copy space, just be aware that was tricky. If Text Console moves out from under you, I'm actually using it as an example of how to build MKI files, so pull the tutorial tree because there's a series of steps of, hey, we were throwing together a Text Console, we did a quick and dirty hack to get one running, and then we did a cleanup on it, then we did a second cleanup on it. These cleanups are converging on the version you would have wanted if you had been building it for a constructor in the first place, and the last version will be the constructor version and something instantiated. Let's come back to this next week. I can't believe the laptop failed. It's time to go, and for a change, I'm actually going to quit on time. Just for variety. Unless people have questions they want to ask them, I'm very happy to take them. Just out of curiosity, because I know I promised a demo, how many of you have actually been able to get a system image running, any system image running? A few people. Okay. And how many of you were sort of waiting until I could do an in-class demo of it? Okay. As I say, I will get my laptop in. In fact, I was driving in this morning and said, oh shit, I should have brought my laptop. By then it was too late to turn around. I will do that next week, but try not to wait. Todd, I think you know how to get an image running, right?
Okay. Not texting
myself. One thing that's a useful thing to trace out to figure out how to get an image running just from the command line level, if you go down into the sys subtree, in the architecture-specific subtrees, you will see that there is a test directory underneath which there is a by-hand directory. So the by-hand tests are the ones that test very low-level function in the kernel, like can we actually dispatch a process at all? So there's a test in there called something very exciting, inc-eax, a program that sits in a loop forever incrementing the eax register. It's not a very exciting program. The reason for this program is if you can get far enough to increment a register, you have gotten far enough to run a program. Whether that program can then make a system call remains to be seen, but that's a significant amount of progress in an operating system. If you go into that directory and you type inc-eax.run, let me be careful. before this will work, go to the top of the tree and come to the source and say, make, and go get coffee. But once the tree is built, you can go into the by hand directory and do a make-eax.run, and you will see it go through the exercise of taking a grub disk, copying your kernel onto it, building an image, which is not a very fancy image, copying the image onto the floppy, booting it under Qemu, and also under a debugger. Depending on whether Qemu wins or the debugger wins, well, in either case, you will get a debugger that issues a GDB prompt. Depending on whether Qemu was already in memory paged in, you will either have stopped Qemu at the grub prompt where it's saying hit return to run the kernel, or you may actually have stopped the kernel at its first instruction. The general idea is that the Qemu start delay built into it, which is intended to be long enough to catch the first kernel instruction. Unfortunately, there's no way to get Qemu to tell us when it is about to run that instruction. So depending on who wins, you may or may not have to hit return explicitly at the grub prompt to get the kernel running. Once you get the kernel running, you may have to say continue to GDB to actually see it do anything. But between these two things and a little bit of fiddling, you'll be able to see the ink EAX process do not a hell of a lot.
Break the debugger.
The debugger? Actually, what I would recommend is just say continue in the debugger unconditionally, because the worst that will happen is it will then stop again and you can say continue again. And this will sort of, and if you then go tear apart the script, you'll see how it built the boot image and how it got this thing running. If you, by the way, you'll also be able to dig in and figure out what was the Qemu command that ran. And if you have any trouble doing that, one of the lines in the make will print out is it will tell you what shell script it's running, right? If you then just run that, once it's running, run the shell script again by hand with sh-x. That will tell you every command that got run inside the shell script, including the Qemu command. If you simply run the Qemu command without any of the surrounding GORP, you won't get the debugger, and the thing will happily run unmolested. But that'll get you to the point where you can hopefully see how an image gets fabricated and assembled, at least in this very trivial case. You know, from there, you can start experimenting with other things in the tree, but at least that'll get you to the point where you confirm that you can build the tree and that you can run Qemu. In order for that script to run, you will need to install, if you have not already, the mTools package. We're going to be updating the Kyotos packages, so that will get installed automatically, but we haven't done it yet. So if you are trying to do this in the next day or two, you may need to install mTools by hand. And if you're running R cross environment packages, sometime in the next 48 hours, this update will happen automatically if you run the update, but not. You may need mTools. The choices were mTools or cross-mount the floppy as a file system, which works fine. In fact, the one that I personally prefer. But on CS418, where we're going to have presumably a bunch of people competing for access to the floppy mount point, that's not such a hot idea. Any other questions? Let me ask you a question. Serial thing is going to push us into a bunch of design issues that are motivated by concurrency problems. Would it be preferable to do something simpler first? What do people think? Making an assumption. Is anybody here still thinking 3 hours into the lecture?
A simpler concurrency example?
Just a simpler initial example, just to get familiarized with. What I was thinking about doing was sort of breaking the project up into stages where the first one amounted to building Hello World, and then, you know, fine, you'll throw away minutes, right? But and go through, I mean, sort of my original model was to go through the stages that way. But what I'm realizing as I think about it, and this design may save it, but what I was realizing as I went through the example on the board is, you know, dealing with concurrent processing loops really does make the program more complicated. And maybe doing something that just handles one request at a time first might make some sense. So would people prefer to do that? I'm happy to do that. Okay. The goal is not to make this impossible, right? The goal is to get a... The reason I picked on the serial thing is I actually wanted people to sort of poke at something that was low level. This may have been too low level to be a good first choice because of the concurrency problem. Ironically,
the right first one to do might have been text console because it's output only, and so it doesn't have any of these concurrency hazards, right? But okay, let me figure out how to do that. Okay, thanks.